Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And we're just talking about a question that a listener asked Fred in regard to testing, specifically the flat part of the curve. And perhaps you could explain what that means.
Well, you've read all these books. You've got the PhD in reliability. You've definitely seen the bathtub curve way too many times, I suspect. And I have made it a point in my career to teach reliability and never show the bathtub curve. I used to have a nice little bathtub I actually use as the symbol for it, right? And it's damaging to our understanding of how products work and then eventually fail. The bathtub curve is probably the most common thing out there, right? And a lot of people want to test their product or evaluate their product because they believe all of the wear out stuff is going to happen long after their warranty period or when customers care. We've designed that to be robust enough for long enough that those won't start for a long, long time. And we're going to really double down on our manufacturing and our supply chain and our initial assembly and training and how our product is put all mastered together. So we completely eliminate, and heaven forbid, then they do like 6 months of burn-in, all of the early failures. So the only thing we have to worry about, and I'm reading between the lines on this question as it came in, is that all I need to do is get efficient at testing the flat part of the curve. And what he meant by that was, well, it's those random failures that occur, like a forklift drives into the side of my car, or a tree branch falls on my car, or I run over a nail on the road, right? Events that generally cause an overstress condition of some sort and lead to a failure. Right? It could be a mistake during a maintenance activity. It could be a lightning strike. It's very, very few things are truly random events, right? So there's
well, lightning strikes are somewhat random.
Unless you live on the East Coast during Hurricane Dorian and they're thunderstorms and tornadoes and high winds and lightning strikes are near constant. Here in California, we get these afternoon showers in the mountains that are dry storms. They don't rain, but they throw out a bunch of lightning. I mean, to me, it's not random when you can predict at 4 o'clock we're going to have a thunderstorm.
Yeah, right? Okay. Yeah, right? I agree.
Right? Here where I live, we hear thunder very, very rarely, right? And so there's very few lightning strikes that ever occur where I live near the coast. Yet, when you look at it in aggregate across the world and the frequency of a lightning strike destroying your cell phone, for example, is such a low probability that it appears completely random, but it's not random. I've been tainted though, Chris. There's one of my classes in my master's program was on a whole semester on randomness. And how do you test something to be random if it really is random or not? And so we proved that Microsoft Excel at the time was anything but a random number, had a capability to create a random number. It was the poster child of how not to create a random number, which was convenient for our professor because we learned about 8 different ways to test for randomness. So anyway, that's my bias.
Sounds like that professor knows how to throw good parties as well, by the sounds of things. But
yeah, it was a fun class. It actually was. and it was, you know, at the time I thought it was completely theoretical, right? And just somewhere along the line, somebody said, oh, if you take a random sample, and I had never really thought through what that meant until I took that class, what that really means. And and how it affects the outcomes of a lot of the frequentist type statistics. If you really don't have a random sample, your math, it'll give you a number, but it'll be pretty much meaningless in some cases. So anyway, it's my bias and side story of a fascinating class. But the area in reliability where people say that's a flat part of the curve, in this question, it was also talking about using the equations that were a zero failure binomial or chi-squared test type stuff, using the exponential, essentially making that underlying assumption and then saying, well, if every hour I have the same probability of failure, I can use more samples and less hours. It's just the total time that it's exposed to. And theoretically, that all works just fine. But it's convenient to assume you're in the flat part of the bathtub curve. It's a completely different thing in practice because you almost never are.
Well, that's...
Go ahead.
Let's go full geek then. So, because I do use the bathtub curve in some of my lessons, but I do it advisedly. So just, I suppose, better go through what the bathtub curve does. And it's the hazard rate or the failure intensity. Essentially, you have this high but decreasing hazard rate, which suggests at the start of the useful life. And typically that's associated with quality issues, manufacturing defects. The reason why that's the case is because nothing ever gets more reliable unless you change its design. And one way of changing its design is taking a defective piece out of it and replacing it with a non-defective piece. You might argue this is still the same design, but if we don't use the term design, we can use the term configuration. The machine...
There's another example that's parallel to that, Chris, is where you have 10% of your widgets that you're installing into your... thousands of units, 10% of them are bad. Mm-hmm. And as that 10% defective widget population weeds itself out early, the rest of them are doing just fine.
Exactly.
And so that it appears like it's an overall, it's a decreasing failure rate because the defective ones are self-ejecting themselves from the pool.
But you're still changing the configuration of the population. So the population consists of fewer and fewer less
defective units.
Yes, yeah. Correct. So, but what happens is there's a physical change in the configuration of your population, whether you repair it to make it change that defective unit to a non-defective unit, or your population has a net or aggregate configuration change as the terrible ones get weeded out early. So that's, you don't actually ever improve reliability per se. It's a statistical trick, but you do see this hazard rate come down, and then the part of the bottom bit of the bathtub curve is a constant hazard rate. And perhaps we should come back to that in a minute because the bit that wears out.
Okay.
Sorry, the third part where the bathtub curve increases is the bit where you experience wear out. And the only failure mechanisms that occur in that region are those where you accumulate damage.
That's right.
Such as cracks getting bigger, lubrication getting more particulate matter, so on and so forth.
Now, there's plenty of examples, and we both know of them, where such a crappy design and assembled so poorly that it immediately wears out, right?
Correct.
So just because we say wear out does not mean it means it happens a long time from now. It can happen very, very quickly, and vice versa. One of those defective little widgets we stuck in a product, it may take years before it manifests as a failure. Right. And yet that, looking at that overall population, it may appear to be a decreasing failure rate or mm-hmm. hazard rate. And so but in general, and I think this is why it's taught so many places, is that if you launch a product in the first couple of weeks, you get some failures return coming back. The first place that is fruitful to look is at your materials and your assembly processes. That's mm-hmm. commonly, not always, but commonly a where that defect comes from, where that problem came from, and vice versa. If something is right around your warranty period or it's after many years of service, then you start looking for wear patterns, and there's all kinds of those things. So that it's a good guideline for investigation. it doesn't mean that it's always there.
That's right. So an example is where you have a defect which increases the stress or stress concentration around a strut or a joint or something like that. And so you have low cycle fatigue early in the life of the system, which is technically wear out. Fatigue mm-hmm. is a wear out failure mechanism, but it occurs in the first week of a product, which is supposed to last 3 years. So from a macro level, this microscopic wear out failure mechanism looks like it's part of the decreasing infant mortality wear in region of the bathtub curve, because from a population perspective, it's in that very, very early period of life where that failure mechanism is being accelerated rapidly, to the extent it appears as if it's part of the background noise of wear in or decreasing hazard rate failures.
That's right.
So that's the bathtub curve.
Yeah. So let's go back to that flat part. And you've seen my slides and presentation on the human mortality, right?
Yep.
10-year-olds are nearly invincible. The early, the early life failures goes until you're about 10. And then if you see your 10th birthday, you're very, very likely, more so in any other year of your life, to see your next birthday. Mm-hmm. It's not guaranteed. There's bad things can happen to 10-year-olds, but they can fall out of trees and walk away, where me at 60 is going to fall out of the tree and not move very much for a while. Right. And then there's a bump at 16, at least in North America, and I think Europe and probably Australia too. I think, is 16 the driving age?
Yeah. Or the year you get out of school.
That's right.
Roughly.
Yeah. During the Army, for example, which I found fascinating when I was looking at mortality tables, is that the military, even in an active war, even in the Second World War, depending on where you were assigned, obviously, but overall, that population had a lower mortality rate than the equivalent cohort of, young male adults in stateside. They killed themselves with accidents and driving and everything else at a rate as great as the population. We have these huge numbers of people being killed in war, but we also had millions of people in arms. So it's mm-hmm. not. Anyway, I digress. But the mm-hmm. the flat part, I have only seen one product that I think they actually understood the failure mechanism that was causing them to have problems in that region, and design testing and their product to deal with it. Most people don't really understand that if I'm going to set up a test, and let's use lightning as the random event that is likely to be their dominant failure mechanism during some period of time, right? Or chance failure. Mm-hmm. And then they put it in a room and they run the product and they operate it, and it runs up and down and left and right, and the green light comes on and they go, all right, great. It survives the flat part of the curve. But it never had an opportunity, being inside a chamber, inside a room, to experience lightning. I mean, it had zero chance at that, or yep. near zero chance. If they don't connect their evaluation to what's the actual probability of a random event occurring to their product, it's pretty much folly, right? And I'm using the example of an outside agent causing the failure. You know, there's plenty of internal agents that can cause a failure in a random way.
Well, I think that's worth talking about, because I'm not sure all our listeners understand what causes the flat part of the bathtub curve, if it does appear. And to elaborate, that's where we see randomly occurring, and what we mean is uniformly randomly occurring, that is something that is just as likely to happen to a brand new unit versus a 100-year-old unit, mm-hmm. external stress. So you use the example of lightning. So when there are these randomly occurring external events where they introduce stresses that immediately induce critical failure.
Yeah, lightning would be doing that. But it also can induce damage that then mm-hmm. eventually leads to it. So it doesn't have to be the vaporizing by lightning.
No, But one good example for our electronics engineers out there, and they're probably aware of this, is where you have dirty power, where you have voltage spikes coming through. That's a classic case of a randomly occurring external stress coming through and frying your circuit board in a way where it will destroy a day-old circuit board versus a 10-year-old circuit board. It doesn't matter how old it is. That voltage spike is going to fry whatever is on that circuit board no matter what.
Yep, that's right. So, but it's that kind of event. And it, if you design a test that says, oh, I know that in a year in the area that we're going to operate, and there was a group in Oak Ridge National Laboratories that characterized powers around the country and around the world, and lightning strikes too. They had a great database full of what's the frequency of different intensities of lightning in different regions of the country. But they would say, all right, you can expect 15, 600 volt, 3 millisecond spikes, or, and they had quantified all these sags and dips and drops and spikes and surges and all these different characteristics of line voltage for different systems. And what was fascinating was the Japanese electrical system was pretty much 100 volts all the time.
Right.
It was just, their system, they took care not to have the great big inductive load on the rest of the circuit so that it would drag everything down and have a dip, and then it wouldn't have spikes, and their switching was very clean, and it was beautiful power. If you want to test your products in a pristine electrical environment, go to Japan. Mm-hmm. If you want to do it in a really bad one, I could give you other recommendations.
Fair enough.
But but if you don't know that that is, you're going to have 15 of these intensity spikes in a year, and you don't include that in your testing of your product, is just operating, for example, or you operate it hard, for example, you don't learn anything about random failures then, or about the flat part of the curve. It has to be tied to the failure mechanism. That's
exactly
what I'm talking about.
So let's go back to what you sort of said, sort of been going through from the start. It's actually quite rare to see this beautiful doctrinal stereotypical bathtub curve. We often see bathtub curves which look nothing like a bathtub. Some of them look more like a tick or a check mark. Yep. They sort of go down quickly and then all of a sudden go straight back up again. So you have all these weird irregular shaped bathtub curves, and it's quite rare to see the flat bottom of a hazard rate. I do have one example, which is not one that most people think of, where you do get this nice flat bottom, but we'll come to that in a minute. So when people think we're talking about, or so when people assume that there's a flat bottom to their hazard rate or failure intensity curve, their assumption is not based on much apart from these textbooks, which continue to pump out these beautiful looking bathtub curves. If it's in the middle of its useful life, we assume that it's not hasn't started to wear out. It's got past its infant mortality quality issues. We assume that there's this flat bottom, and a lot of the time that simply doesn't exist. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you're interested, if let's just say by some fluke of nature, you actually do have a flat bottom of your bathtub curve, and you are interested in accelerating the testing or accelerating failures in testing where you're targeting that flat bottom, then what you're talking about, Fred, is essentially you need to characterize the environment and understand the frequency of these randomly occurring external stresses and make them occur more often and with greater intensity, which is something which is very, very difficult to do. And you cannot then, if you're increasing their intensity, then there's no chance of you understanding, quantifying the extent to which you're accelerating. That is, if you're making each voltage spike twice as big, that doesn't mean that 1 year of testing is equivalent to 2 years of useful life. Far from it. You need to accelerate the frequency of these voltage spikes, for example, and then you might be able to equate 1 year of testing to 2 years of useful life or something similar. But the problem is characterizing the environment to that level of detail is not impossible. How often will you get struck by lightning, for example? How often will these voltage spikes come through? And if you do know these numbers, then you can increase the frequency during testing. But it comes back to, what are you trying to do? If that flat, that hypothetical flat bottom is where the margins are being defeated by these external stresses, which means that you might just simply actually want to do something like HALT, where you work out the weak points very quickly and improve the margins of your system so the operational limits and the destruct limits are pushed further and further and further away. So you get a robust design where, which if it does have this flat bottom, that flat bottom exists at a much lower slash better place.
That's right.
So without knowing exactly what our listener is trying to achieve, if they're trying to genuinely accelerate testing from a measuring perspective, they need to increase the frequency of these randomly occurring external events, which they've had to study and characterize, so on and so forth. Almost impossible to do.
It is. And I mean, we used a couple of, you know, visually appealing examples like voltage spikes and lightning strikes. And it's an overstress, but it also could be that forklift driving into it, or it could be yes. somebody drops a wrench into the gear train on something, or it could be there's a forest fire, which we have a little bit too often out here in California. Mm-hmm. And that smoke gets sucked in and fouls your filters and air intake systems and creates creosote based coatings all over your electronics. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of ways that most any product can fail. And there's a finite probability for every one of those, although rare in vast majority of cases, they all exist. So if I study one or two of those, I'm ignoring by choice then all the others, which still have collectively as much or more of a probability of occurring than the two that I happen to study. So I don't really learn a lot. And I mean, there are rare cases where the random events, like dropping something, is dominant. It's just head and shoulders over the probability of all the other ones combined. And then focusing on dropping, the damage done through dropping, you can use that then to do it. But I agree with you, Chris. It is exceedingly difficult, and it's very, very rare that you have a dominant random failure or random force applied to your product that will be worth studying. And mm-hmm. and then on top of that is that check mark or tick mark kind of thing is what I've seen in, I have not seen data that showed pretty much anything except that. And I think there are a few hypothetical ones out there that I've heard about that could go flat for a while, but no, not for anything that we really, really care about. And just because you assume it doesn't make it so.
That's true. So I'll tell you about the example I have where you do see this flat bottom one, and it's a bit different to the typical reliability analysis. And that is, when I was looking at, we called it ROFAS, rate of occurrence of failure after servicing. And what we're trying to do is characterize the hazard rate of a fleet of vehicles after it was serviced. So the random variable, let's call it T, was reset to zero every time the vehicle got serviced.
Okay.
So we had data from an entire fleet of vehicles, and they had been around for a while, so the data went back at least 10 years. But what that meant was when a 10-year-old vehicle got serviced, it was this T value, this T random variable, not random variable, sorry, T usage metric was reset to zero. The same thing would occur for a brand new vehicle. So age was essentially taken out of this consideration. Mm-hmm. That doesn't matter how old or how young this vehicle was. As soon as it got serviced, this usage metric got reset to zero.
I wasn't part of that maintenance team because it certainly wouldn't be zero when I did it, and probably less than zero.
Well, what we found actually was the maintenance-induced failures were substantial. So the first meter driven outside of the workshop, the vehicle was about 1,000 times more likely to fail than that same meter driven 10,000
Oh, I can relate to that. Yeah, I can relate to that.
And that's just, it's just a fact of life. And if anyone's been involved in reliability growth analysis or analysis of wear and failure mechanisms, we all, and there's a few of you out there, we all know that when you do it, you'll find this, that front part of the bathtub curve has what we call the Weibull intensity. That is, if you plot it in logarithmic axes, it will form a straight line, and the shape parameter will always be between 0.3 to 0.5. Just for food for thought, infant mortality, liability, things where you see this decreasing hazard rate, the shape parameter or the gradient in the log-log space is always in the order of 0.3 to 0.5. And then when we did the analysis, we did hit this beautiful flat bottom of this bathtub curve. But it was somewhat misleading because this included failures that were, for example, things being wearing out and being replaced. So these failures were occurring, but because if these failures were unrelated to the servicing, that is, it was if you service part A of the vehicle and any other failure in part B occurs, then that will, again, be uniformly randomly occurring. So that's just the flat bathtub hazard rate noise, for lack of a better term. The only way you would ever see wear out is when things that are associated with the preventive maintenance or servicing started to wear out. So because of that, we only ever saw the back of the bathtub curve kick in once the things that we were touching during servicing started to wear out, like oils and gaskets and things like that. So we had the stereotypical beautiful bathtub curve in that example, and that example only, because statistically we were doing things to it which essentially uniformly randomized all the other stuff we weren't touching during servicing. But that is the only example I've ever seen where you can produce this flat bottom for your bathtub curve. And that doesn't really help you in terms of life planning. It does help you in terms of trying to understand when you need to service. But I don't sense that's where our question's coming from.
No. And to me, it goes, and I've seen this from a number of other folks and other questions over the years, is that, if I double the time I'm testing, is that a way to accelerate this, or do I get a better answer? I only get three samples, so I have to, according to the formula, I have to do it 5 years worth of testing, things like that. And it generally means somebody's picked up a textbook, ran into the chi-squared test planning type things, or they're assuming it's a flat part of the curve and they're using a zero failures out of binomial kinds of things. And it's all usually done to be the most efficient testing, right? The fewest samples and fewest time and those kinds of constraints. What's missing from many of those texts and it's missing from this thought process is, well, what's the mechanism I'm evaluating? Mm-hmm. Am I even applying stress that's relevant? What am I actually trying to activate or to anticipate or look for or whatever? I don't always need a failure, but if I don't know what I'm evaluating for in a failure mechanism way, right, at the fundamental level of what initiates to a failure, I'm usually just shooting in the dark at that point. I have no idea if this set of stresses I'm applying have any rational basis to do anything to my product, good or bad. And that's kind of silly to me. Mm-hmm. And so the beyond just the flat part in the assumptions of an exponential distribution is you got to get past that. You got to start thinking about, well, what is the risky things? What do I need to learn? What do I need to evaluate? What can I do that's actually going to add value back to the team or for the customer? There's so many parts to the question that I go, this is symptomatic of a much bigger problem, our education system around reliability. Mm-hmm. And it's also a lack of insight into how your product works and doesn't work. What kind of risks is it really facing? And I look at it that way. And then when you get into the math and everything else, and you start checking those assumptions, you very quickly realize that none of those assumptions of it's we're in the flat part of the curve actually hold water, to continue that analogy.
I wonder if we could ask that listener who asked the question if they could provide us with the decision or the review that they're trying to influence. What is the point of accelerating this so-called flat part of the bathtub curve? What are we trying to do? What are we trying to learn? For what purpose are we doing this testing? That might help us understand what we would do in that situation.
Yeah, good point. I'll have to get back to him because I just got the question this morning and I hadn't even responded to it yet. Mm-hmm. So it's I wanted to chat with you a little bit about it because I wanted to see if I could temper my answer a little bit, make it less more appealing and help them see what they need to do.
Or it could be just that they're using the terminology in a different way. Some people could refer to the useful life of this product as the flat bottom bathtub curve. It's not necessarily literally correct, but if they're trying to just say we want to move past wear in and wear out failures, or the dominant ones at least, or how can we accelerate the useful testing where we're focused on the useful life of the system, even though we probably won't see this flat bottom of a bathtub curve. Who knows? Maybe that's but that answer could help clarify our response.
No, he even gave me the formula right off of Weibull.com for the amount of time for your test, given your MTTF and the chi-squared, what confidence you want to run it at. And I'm like, no.
Terrific. Yeah.
And then very quickly equated it to the stress strength concept in the formula there, using a normal assumption, which we didn't even touch on in this discussion, but that'll take us another half hour. Yeah. Okay. I'll try to put something useful together. And hopefully I'll also point to this recording because it'll be out shortly. And hopefully that helps them also.
Absolutely.
That'd be cool. All right, cool. So I hesitate to ask this question. It just popped in my mind to our audience. If you're listening and you're thinking about an assumption that governs the way you design your test, you know, have you tested it? Have you checked that assumption? Do you have a solid basis for using that assumption? If not, test it. And I'd love to hear what you get as results. What is supporting your ability to do your job as a reliability engineer, and what's clouding it, making it more difficult for you to get meaningful results out of the work you're doing? And I know that's a tough ask, and maybe it's a, what do they call it? A question where I don't really need an answer. It's to make you think, right? So as you're setting up evaluations or you're working with your reliability program and all these different tasks we do, what assumptions are you making, and are they valid? And then how do you know? That would be a good question to ask yourself. Rhetorical Absolutely. Question. That's the answer. So I'm going to not ask any more questions for the rest of the day. I think I'm going to take a nap after this discussion. So thanks a lot, Chris. Thanks for chatting with me on this one. And I think I've framed a bit of a better answer to get back to this question.
No worries, Fred. Happy to help. And obviously I enjoy having these conversations.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Talk to you later.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.